Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. And, you know, I hope that a lot of you realize that many of my much of my time on the radio with guests, it's not so much an interview as it is a conversation. And that's especially true of one of my most frequent guests, I think probably the most frequent, Brad Coates, a good friend of some 20-plus years, a frequent guest on this program. Hello, Brad. It's nice to have you back.
Hello, Diana, and aloha from Hawaii to all of your listeners.
Yes, a lot of people are going to be envious. They'll be wanting to be in Hawaii. Is it just beautiful there in paradise?
Of course. I wouldn't have it any other way.
Yeah, I know. You were drawn to Hawaii a long time ago. You were at, was it UCLA's law school? And
yeah.
And then you did
Southern California boy originally. And, you know, what's the old salutation? Go west, young man. It's hard to figure out where else to go west from California. But I actually overflew Hawaii first and wound up in Micronesia, and then I've been an island guy ever since. So now I've been in Hawaii for the last 40 years. So
yes, the last 40 years, heading up the biggest divorce firm in Hawaii. And Brad's book, Divorce with Decency, the subtitle is The Complete How-To Handbook and Survivor's Guide to the Legal, Emotional, Economic, and Social Issues. Now in its fifth edition. It's really been a popular book, but it isn't just about divorce, which makes it really appealing to many of the people that I have referred to, not only on this program, but in my practice. You're a little bit of a sociologist, too, as you write this book.
You know, the Coates and Fry law firm that I run in Hawaii is the biggest divorce firm in Hawaii and has been for decades now. And this book is popular not only with divorce clients, but I'll just read you the cover that the former chief judge of the family court here in Hawaii wrote. He said, "It's far more than just a divorce book. It's an all-encompassing survey of love, marriage, and romantic relationships in modern life." And that's really what I've tried to do, is to try and analyze where all, you know, things are going for you know, romance and not just marriage, but, raising families and how society is going to adjust to the different trends of how people mate and mingle and nowadays it's more of a failing to they may be mating and they're still procreating, but they're not getting married the way they used to. That marriage is way, way down compared to the way it was, and certainly in our generation, Diana.
Yes, Brad, and we've talked about that on previous shows, and we're the focus for this show. You sent me an outline, and I think it's excellent. America's growing gender gap between men and women, and you have in your book some very important distinctions about women's increasing economic power. You call it the rise of the she economy. You want to talk briefly about that? We have discussed this before, so I'm thinking we might move on after this section and women's increasing economic power as well as educational achievements, and then go on to sex and pornography, and then the Me Too movement, further divisiveness.
I knew you'd get us to sex eventually. There's no question about the increasing educational achievement. We have discussed that, about how in the 1970s, 64%, almost two-thirds of college graduates and higher degrees were men, and only about one-third were women. And now that's totally reversed. Over 50% are now women, both advanced degrees and college degrees. So the she economy has reflected that, where you get a situation where, you know, almost half of all female, half of all the workforce now is half female. women owning a third of all companies, women being the main breadwinner in about 22% of all U.S. households, up from only about 7% in 1970. So women no longer need to rely on their male partners economically, and that's caused them to move forward, and they file about females file about two-thirds of all divorces nationwide. So that is a huge social, economic, and demographic game changer. And then in this last set of elections, you know, we're not only talking about economic power, we're talking about political power. You saw how many wahines, which is Hawaiian for women, were elected to the House of Representatives in staggering numbers. So it's definitely a great trend for women. And I am somebody who actually love power to see powerful women move forward. But it is, as a divorce lawyer, I can't help but wonder if it's not going to change a lot of the traditional roles in marriage, and then ultimately probably result in more divorce business for my firm. I don't know.
Probably. I heard something on National Public Radio that for the first time ever, those receiving Rhodes scholarships. And this is a complete, like Bill Clinton won one, where he got to study at Oxford for 2 years. It's a full scholarship. And this year, I think of the 86 Rhodes scholarships, these are all American people, most of them were women. And
not
I think
surprising.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's,
that's very prestigious to be able to study at Oxford, and yes. So I think it is interesting. And you quoted Mazie Hirono as saying, and she's in the Senate in Hawaii. What is she again?
She's a U.S. senator from Hawaii, and she's been a long-term politician here. She's on the Judiciary Committee. So she got involved in the Kavanaugh hearings, which were, again, another sort of divisive gap-widening process. When she called out, the direct quote was something along the lines of, "Men of America must shut up and stand up," you know, which
yeah,
was...
Yeah, and what did she mean by... I do remember seeing her now and thinking, oh, this is a woman who speaks her mind, and she's very clever. So what do you think
she's
she meant?
Always been a, she's always been
that.
A strong woman, and the Kavanaugh hearings engendered a lot of strong feelings on both sides. It's definitely true that that men should, and I think that's a real change. I think that the days I was watching something about the old speaking of Bill Clinton, his situation with Monica Lewinsky. I'm not sure he would have gotten off so easy he got impeached, but he didn't get thrown out. He was basically hitting on, that was a power imbalance of a senior management person hitting on a junior employee. And I think probably that would be actionable nowadays.
The politics of it
were wild back then, but I think nowadays that's definitely changed in the days of hashtag Me Too. I don't think anybody, can go around, slapping women on the butt or forcing any woman to do anything she doesn't want to do without facing serious ramifications, as we saw with Weinstein and all these other guys. So that part is great. I mean, I love to see things even out between the genders. But when Mazie Hirono says something like "Men of America must shut up and stand up," how does that make the men that have not? I mean, I'm sure she was referring to those guys who are chauvinist, misogynist jerks. And I don't like those guys either. But how does it make the rest of us feel that have never hit on our employees, have never hit on our clients, have never tried to talk down to women? All of a sudden you got somebody tarring you with the same broad brush that they were trying to tar Kavanaugh with. So. There's an interesting,
you make a very good point.
There's an interesting term.
You make a very
good
point.
When we talk about misogyny, I'd never heard the flip side of that term called misandry, which is a term when women essentially hate men. I mean, you know, the misogyny is when, you know, men hate and abuse women. But now all of a sudden we got the flip side going where now, you know, the misandry, the hatred of men by women, it seems to be taking hold. So it's just, like I say, I don't know if there's any right, wrong, bright line, but there is definitely, I can see it, a growing gap, between the genders, which I think is going to make it harder to keep marriage and other long-term relationships together. That would be my prediction.
I think your prediction, of course, is accurate. And the reason we're going to get into sex and pornography and sexuality in general is that part of the inevitable result, as you say, is that it's going to be so much harder to hold marriage and other romantic relationships together. And I would say that it's a big part of that is that there's lots of erotic erosion. And erotic erosion.
That's a good way of putting it. There's certainly the danger of erotic erosion. I've never heard that term before, but it's perfect. Between couples and especially between long-standing couples, and there is also the flip side is there's so many more options with online porn, internet dating, everything every Tinder and all these crazy websites that you can go on and for hookup sites. Basically, they're not really relationship sites; they're hookup sites. So now you've got a situation where Not only is the eros eroding between the couple itself, maybe, but then there's so many other temptations, so easily accessed outside of the coupley relationship. I mean, it used to be that you had sex with your spouse because you didn't really have any choice. That was the only person you were going to be able to have sex with. Now there's dozens and dozens of other options, and that's a little scary.
Well, indeed it is, and I think that you mentioned, and I did too in one of the previous shows, the Viagra divorces contribute to, the erectile dysfunction drugs do embolden older men and infuriate older women. The man who thinks that, oh, now I can get an erection, so I want to have sex with my wife again, and she says, well, wait a minute, honey. You haven't been nice to me for the last 10 years. Why would I want to have sex with you? So
I think the first time I heard that term, as is true of so many terms, is from you, the Viagra divorce. And as a divorce lawyer, I probably should have heard it sooner, but you're exactly right. I mean, that when you think about it, that operates on a lot of levels. I mean, Mother Nature used to have the genders wind down their sexuality sort of in tandem. As you got older, you got to be, late 50s, 60s, they say it starts diminishing even in your 40s, but certainly by late 50s, 60s, 70s, probably both halves of the couple would have, had previously sort of, I won't say thrown in the towel completely, but I mean, certainly having, rabid sex was not top priority in most long-term relationships by the time you're 70 years old. But now that, and that's probably still true for women who are, drying up might be an improper term to use, but I mean, they're not, it's just harder sometimes for older women to get very excited about sex, I think. Now, and it would have been true of their mates too, except for now he can take a pill where suddenly he's excited, even though she's not, and now you've got those sets of expectations. Not to mention the actual mechanics of the sex act where, you and I have discussed before, whereas a guy can complete the sex act, so rapidly, and maybe too rapidly, in 4 to 5 minutes, a woman takes, what was this, about 18 minutes of foreplay alone to get very excited about it. So now you've got a guy who's got an instant erection thanks to the blue pill, and now he skimps on the foreplay even worse than he used to. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yes. There, in recent years, there's been a lot of research around women's sexuality and the multidimensionality of it, and that it's more subjective, it's more it has a more relational sort of aspect to it, and its reliance on a delicate balance of conditions. But the what's happened is, so all this research on women's sexuality, and then there has been sort of the men have not done well because there's less research on male sexuality, thinking that men's sexuality is not so difficult. It's you know, it's a matter of blood flow and getting it up, and that's not true, because men's sexuality, in a lot of research, or not research, because we need more of it, but what we have of it and what I see with my clients is that men's sexuality is dependent on their inner life, and that it's way more than a biological urge, and that sex, gender, and identity are deeply interrelated for men. So we're not giving men enough acknowledgement here about the complexities of male sexuality, that it isn't just all or nothing. So this, I think, increases the shame and the performance anxiety and the fear of rejection for men. They're not understood, and by a lot of people. And so I love your reaction to that, and I also want to talk about why it's so easy for men to just go to porn or paid sex and that sort of thing.
Well, I think it's always been true that for women, and you know, all the studies show this, that you know, the women care more about mood and courtship and candlelight mm-hmm. and foreplay rather than just the sex act themselves. I mean, there's lots of I've heard lots of quotes about how women prefer kissing to the actual sex act. You know, I think there's no question but what guys also are turned on by elements of that. And you know, I think you know, especially when you see stuff like, you know, the fantasy aspect of it, which isn't exactly the sex act per se. It's maybe, you know, it's maybe like, you know, role playing or different, you know, different elements of, you know, guys aren't as intrigued by maybe candlelight, but they're maybe intrigued by, you know, watching a girl slowly, you know, disrobe before him or whatever. I mean, you know, I think guys are a little more sensitive than just, okay, I've got an erection, now where do I put it? But
oh yeah, most are. But, I mean, there are a lot of stereotypes around this, but
yeah, that's right. But there is also, it's also true that you know, men are, what's the old saying? Men are slime, at least when it comes to the old issue of, you know, if a man finds his way to a new woman, a younger woman, a naked woman, with a slender body, he can get aroused without necessarily having to have discussions of Jung and Freud and Kierkegaard. Men can overlook a lot of the more in-depth emotional communication if something comes along that makes them hard, then they follow that hard on. I mean, that's men are a lot more shallow than women in that regard.
No doubt, but I think some of it has kind of been forced upon them. There are some men that just don't want the emotional entanglements, and so when they have all of these conflicting, like say a long-term relationship, and are they going to have an affair or not, they have all these conflicting ideas, and it might be just the easier route to take to watch porn, to jerk off to porn, to pay for sex, and maybe, you know, swipe left or what, maybe left or right. I've forgotten which direction it is because I don't use Tinder. But anyway, it can be just easier to go that route. And, so
it's because, certainly getting easier still. Yeah. I mean, you know, with the proliferation mm-hmm. of pornography, the availability of it and the fact that, you know, it may be easier to sit in a dark room and turn on your computer and watch some 18-year-old, you know, dance for you and do all kinds of things that you wouldn't in your wildest imagination expect your wife to do. And she doesn't look like your wife, and she, you know, she doesn't certainly act like your wife, and you know, all of that comes into play. And now, I mean, you know, how does a spouse compete with, you know, 20-year-old, whatever their legal age is, a stripper who's, you know, got siliconed up everything and, you know, and wearing spike heels and spandex and, you know, and your wife's wearing what we call muumuus over here, her house dress or whatever. It's just, it's a different thing, and it certainly is easier as far as the, a man playing up to his own expectation, rather than waiting for a gal to figure it out and do it for him. Although women that can figure it out and do it for him certainly have a leg up, so to speak, in relationships, I think. I think this I've seen happen a lot where women say, we've been married for 30 years, shouldn't the sex thing be over by now? And she just gaffs it off. And I think, women do that at their peril because men seem to stay interested in sex longer than women do as a general rule. Well, you're the expert on that. What do you think the differences are between the different sexual needs and desires of men versus women?
Well, I think in general, men, you're right, men remain sexual. A lot of studies have shown this. They're interested in sex, including some studies that I did with Dr. Walter Bortz in the early 90s in Palo Alto, where we did a series at the Palo Alto Senior Center, and then we followed up 6 months later. We gave them questionnaires, and we also spoke to some 1,300 sons in retirement, sirs, and gave them questionnaires. Anyway, what came out of our research, which was published in medical journals, and that's why I can call myself a gerontologist, is that men do continue to be interested, but they must have an interesting and equally or somewhat at least interested partner. But they do stay interested. Now, some of them are on medications, that these older guys that interfere with erections. And I remember one elderly guy, maybe mid-80s, he said, well, he came up afterwards, he didn't want to ask it in the big group. He said, well, I'm having ED, and this is, by the way, this was before Viagra when we were doing these studies. He said, but my doctor said, well, what? He said, would you rather have a heart attack or an erection? I mean, it was, because...
Interesting choice.
Well, yeah, but then, there are other solutions. Like one reason you're a healthy older man, one reason my husband is a healthy older man is exercise. You do regular exercise. You're runners, you're swimmers, you do all of those things. And that increases blood flow in your bodies, which, of course, affects the penis. And so men, especially healthy men, they'll retain interest right on through. Others just kind of throw in the towel and say, well, I'm not so interested because I can't. The performance anxiety comes in. And so that's...
Well, that's another, I think that's another mm-hmm. biggie for guys. I mean, it's not just, it's not just the sex act itself. It's the fact that you're losing a whole part of your maleness if that starts to trickle down. And one thing guys are, have a better percentage chance of performing as if they're doing it themselves. I mean, if you're watching porn and masturbating, your performance anxiety drops down because you're pretty likely to get a result. Whereas if you've got to do some work for a gal, especially if she's not necessarily proactive about the way she handles you and your member, then you got a higher chance that it's not gonna pop up, not gonna pan out, and then you do have performance failure. So that's spooky for a guy.
Very spooky. And when a guy watches porn, the girl on the screen is irresistible. He doesn't have to seduce her. She never rejects him. He doesn't have to feel inadequate. And her moans, her vocalizations on the screen might assure him that she's having the the best fun possible. And, of course, it's all fantasy, but a man who has ED with a partner or who has premature ejaculation with a partner, I have found when I ask questions in my couples counseling or my individual counseling, when you masturbate to porn, do you have these problems? And they don't. They don't have them. They don't have to worry about all of those things that I just said. Seducing a woman.
Do you have any
pleasing a woman?
Oh, go ahead.
No, sorry. Do I have any what?
Do you have any sense of whether there's, I know this is a broad generalization, a predictable age break or percentages as to how many more women than men kind of tire of sex or you know, beg off of it? Or is there a particular age that you can point to where, you know, I think women in their 20s are, you know, are sexier than men. And actually women, I think, you know, whereas guys' performance peaks out in their late teens or early 20s, women go on till their late 30s, as I recall, as far as their, you know, their sexual abilities and desires. But, you know, do you have any sense of when all that starts to slow down or change?
Well, for women, it starts to change with perimenopause, and which can be 5+ years before the actual onset of menopause, or the actual menopause, which is defined by 1 year without any menstrual cycle. So her hormones, her estrogen has gone way down. That affects her orgasms. Her progesterone is off. Her testosterone levels are low. And we have similar parallel things for men, and sometimes it's been called manopause. And it may have to do with kind of a midlife crisis. It'll be somewhere around midlife. And the man might...
Midlife as defined by what, 40 or 50 or?
45, 50, 55. And a lot of guys, if they're in relationships that aren't very sexy, they'll often start to look elsewhere. But they're also really often very perturbed by not being able to have erections. So I had one... guys say in my practice, and I'm quoting him, the old zest starts going in your 50s. There's no question about it. Men will often run after other women at that age, but the point is that the same cycle starts all over again. They might run after women, you know, hoping to capture a younger woman and not feel that they're getting older. If the younger woman can be interested in them, so it's because the man is experiencing challenges to his vitality and his virility both. And
you chase him and maybe catch him and then don't know what to do with him.
happens. Yeah. So middle life pause or manopause for short. It's a 5 to 12 year period during which men go through hormonal fluctuations coupled with accelerated physical and psychological changes. That's what happens. And at one study, it's a little bit old. It's about a 20-year-old study, but I think it's been duplicated. 52% of healthy American men between the ages of 40 and 70 can experience some degree of impotence. That's not very encouraging news, is it, Bradley?
No, but it's not. It's certainly not surprising.
Right.
You know, I'm 67 at this point, and it's you know, fortunately, and you know, the basic plumbing still works, but it doesn't work the way it used to. It gets to be a trickier process.
Right.
So it is interesting to watch, and like I say, to return to the topic that we're started with about the, you know, how this is causing even a growing gap between men and women. I mean, I think, you know, your term, the Viagra divorces, is a serious one, because, you know, now men can seemingly, you know, solve the problem, and they haven't really come up with something similar. There's always talk about something that makes women almost as horny as Viagra makes men, but you know, it's not quite there yet, at least to my knowledge. And,
no.
And I'm not sure a lot of women would really, you know, even if there was a magic potion, I'm not sure a lot of women would want to take it by the time they're 60 or 70 years old. I think, you know, I think one of the things that is definitely happening is that you know, women generally get sick of guys, you know, later on in life. I mean, if you're a Wahini who's taken care of a guy and cooked and cleaned and, you know, raised the family, and you know, all he's done is sit in his lazy boy lounger and watch ESPN, you know, sports on TV, and drink too much, you know, I know a lot of women that are, you know, once they get divorced in my office, they're not dying to go back and find a new husband. I mean, a lot of times when I'm doing a divorce for a woman who's in her 30s, you know, they'll be saying, "Oh yeah, I've got a new boyfriend. I'm looking for a new boyfriend, or do you know where I can find a new boyfriend?" You know, like, I've got a roster of divorced guys. Maybe I should have gone to the computer dating business years ago, because I've always had, you know, clients from both sides that are looking to do whatever's their next act. But
You've been a matchmaker.
I can't even make my own matches. Yeah, but I find that there are fewer and fewer women that come out all that enthusiastically looking for a new mate if they're getting divorced at 50 or 60. And then you get, you know, what you and I have talked about before, the Jane Fonda syndrome, where, you know, she's had a life that's been, you know, had all kinds of interesting, exciting aspects of it, with you know, some of the more, you know, fascinating husbands that any woman could ever want. And when she's asked about, you know, which one she might prefer to be with again, or, you know, who she wants next, you know, she says nobody. She says, you know, I'd rather hang out with my girlfriends. And that's pretty true.
She says, the shop is closed up down there. And that was deeply disappointing for me to read, because I loved her book. I know you know it too, Prime, and very well-researched book. And at the time she wrote the book, she was in a very sexual, passionate relationship with a man for several years. And before that, she'd been married to Ted Turner. He was pretty dynamic. And she's had, but now she says, she's 80, but, you know, she looks fabulous, and she has always exercised. We know that about her. But I thought, oh, she was such a good model for aging and sexuality. So personally, I was disappointed that she said, my shop is closed up down there.
Yeah, you're right. I've followed her kind of as a role model of what you wanted to believe in, and her book, that Prime Time book, which was written in her 70s, still sounded very enthusiastic about life and love and all kinds of things. And now the most recent documentary that was done about her on, I think it was HBO, called Life in Five Acts, and it talked about, you know, her growing up was the first act, and then her marriage to Roger Vadim, and Tom Hayden, and then Ted Turner, three pretty interesting guys. And then the fifth act now is, you know, life on her own with her girlfriends and no guys, and she's kind of making a statement that that's the way she prefers it. So it was kind of a turnaround, and I see this happening, especially with my older, you know, if I do a divorce for an older guy, you know, he's out to find a new woman, mainly to take care of him pretty quickly, because men need women more than women need men, especially, I mean, women need men when they're at their young age and they've got the maternal instinct and they want somebody to father their children. But what I'm seeing more and more of is that, you know, once that's done, the women bow out of these relationships faster than the guys do. And as I mentioned, it's the Wahinis that file for 2/3 of all divorces nationwide and in Hawaii. They're the ones that get sick of the guys faster than the guys get sick of the girls.
It would seem so. And they like their independence. They like living alone. They don't want to have to cook and be a slave to a man. And then you have a lot of, I've used this term when we've talked about this before, Brad. a lot of older guys are looking for a nurse with a purse.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They want somebody to take care of them who also has money. And a lot of women don't want to sign up for that.
No. I think a lot of women don't want to sign on for, you know, an ongoing relationship with a guy, period. I mean, it's really, it's traceable in my practice.
Yeah. Yeah.
So to go back to this, you know, the widening gender gap, I mean, you know, I'll tell you, one of the things that's done it is the hashtag Me Too movement. I mean, certainly you don't want men who are in superior positions in the business or political world or in Hollywood or wherever, the Weinstein kind of thing, you know, forcing women to have sex as a prerequisite for expanding their careers. That, you know, that is long overdue, and I think that's a great outgrowth of the hashtag Me Too. And, you know, the expanded awareness of the prevalence of abuse. They say that hotline calls increased several 100% during the you know, the abuse hotline calls increased several 100% after the Kavanaugh hearings. You know, it's definitely that kind of an expanded awareness is long overdue. You know, but when it flips over and turns into the Maisie Hirono, you know, all men suck. Which is a bit of a, you know, over exaggeration of her remarks.
But, I would say that.
That is, you know, then you get both genders getting more and more defensive and more irritated by the opposite gender. It's an interesting stage that we're at now with all the advances that women have seen. You know, to go back to the issue of the women's increasing educational achievements and financial and economic achievements with the she economy and all that, I don't know if you saw this new law that California put through that mandates a minimum number of women on boards of directors for corporations over a certain size. I mean, you're California, the progressive, you know, most progressive state of all, is now. Gone on and said, hey, we want a minimum number of women on boards of directors of companies that are over X amount of dollars, which is, I mean, you know, that's kind of almost a reverse discrimination situation. So it's really, and all that stuff, you know, if you're a guy who's sitting at home watching, you know, I don't care whether you watch Fox or CNN, or I guess you'd see more of it on CNN. You know, there's this huge gap growing within the country to begin with. And if you're a guy, and it's shown just by which channel of TV news you watch, that's why I mentioned that. You know, you're sitting there watching CNN talk about how, you know, how horrible, Kavanaugh is and must have been, and why he shouldn't be on the Supreme Court, and, you know, all men are horrible, and your wife is, you know, cheering every time she hears Maisie Hirono talk, and you're sitting there, you know, just minding your own business and watching this whole thing. I mean, before long, you know, that becomes, you know, mildly offensive or maybe really offensive and certainly somewhat threatening to you. So now, you know, now the guys become more distrustful of their wives. The wives become more distrustful of their husbands. I mean, this is a gap that is going to have serious sociological repercussions in America and, you know, maybe, you know, around the world. I mean, it's going to be a while, I guess, before it takes hold in Saudi Arabia. But it is certainly affecting America and I think probably it's going to have a trickle down effect, you know, in a lot of places around the world. We can talk about Japan later, but tell me what you think.
Let's talk about Japan now. I think it fits in because you're very familiar with Japan. I did some research in the early 90s in Japan. I'm somewhat familiar, but talk about Japan because it can reflect. It's a developed nation, and it. Yeah, talk about Japan and how it might reflect on what we're talking about. The growing gender gap.
You know, I've always viewed Japan and some of the other Asian dragon countries as being kind of a predictive trendsetter. In Japan, the Japanese women, a lot, and again, this is an overgeneralization, but a lot of them do not. The Japanese women do not want to marry Japanese guys. The cultural tradition in Japan is that if you, you know, as a gal, you marry a Japanese husband, you know, he works till, you know, midnight every night, or says he's working till midnight every night. Maybe he only works till 10, and then he's up in the Ginza, you know, chasing geishas or whatever. I don't think there's geishas left in the Ginza anymore, but you know, he you almost, you know, you're picking, you know, girls that are you know, professional, you know, bar girls, basically, rather than going home to your wife, because and the wife is not happy because she's stuck at home with the guy's mother doing all the heavy lifting for the family, and the, you know, the genders have just literally, you know, gone their separate ways, which has resulted, you know, in a very low birth rate for Japan, also a very low birth rate in Korea. You know, the more economic affluence a nation achieves, the lower its birth rate, the further it gets from a agrarian society where you needed seven kids to plow the fields and pick the cotton and I guess got cotton or can the peaches, whatever. You know, you needed you needed a whole tribe to run an agrarian household, and now, you know, now you don't need that. And so everybody gets used to doing their own thing. So now you've got, I mean, Japan is leading the way on literally robotic sex, where you can just you know, plug the male member right into a robotic sex doll and have it do whatever it does to make you explode in a way that, you know, maybe, you know, your wife, who's, like I say, no longer interested in you, is not going to be doing. I mean, it's really, it's a pronounced division within the genders for in Japan, and I start, you know, I'm starting to see it in with China, where a lot of women were raised really you know, really strong to be strong women. I mean, you know, that this is kind of off target, off topic a little bit, but you know, Mao Zedong's wife, Mrs. Mao, was a very strong feminist, and one thing that they did in China was you know, women had all the same opportunities economically that guys did from a very young age. Sports was all, you know, both genders. And so, you know, a lot of these Chinese women come out saying, you know, we're the daughters of Chairman Mao, and we definitely feel totally equal. So that, you know, again, I'm all for equality, but it's, you know, for years, centuries, human biology relied on testosterone-driven males for the propagation of the species. I mean, that's basically Darwinism. And now we're headed in a totally different direction without any Surgeon's General warning to tell us, you know, like they had for smoking. You know, you smoke now, you're going to get cancer. We're opening up whole new paths in society without any real clue as to where it's all going to lead. So it's a fascinating time, really, to be analyzing this kind of stuff and writing books and talking on your show and, you know, running a business that is really dependent on a lot of these topics.
Or for me, having a private practice where I see lots and lots of couples at various stages in their relationships and life, and it's fascinating. Yes, it's a very, very, there are lots of transitions going on right now, and there are so many factors that play into this. So some of these guys wonder in an individual session, because sometimes I'll see a couple, but I get asked to see them individually, and it turns out that maybe the guy is having an affair, a secret that I will keep because it doesn't necessarily affect the counseling, the marriage counseling. And so one guy said, but how can I still be interested in sex anywhere but with my wife? And that comes from a long-term relationship where sex has become kind of dull and they want the vitality back. But as I said earlier, a lot of men solve this problem with themselves by turning to less emotionally complicated forms of sex, including the masturbation and pain for sex. And so I think that's very interesting. But we don't, yeah, I think that's very interesting.
Well, it's, and, go ahead.
Well, you know, to go back, because this, we were talking about the Me Too movement. You know, men have a history that kind of leads them to some of these attitudes. Like, in locker rooms, fraternity houses, and other all-male spaces, a lot of guys will hear that sex is about conquest. and about asserting masculinity through domination of girls' bodies. And it's you just don't hear a guy say, "Hey, dude, I made her feel great." A guy is more likely to say, "Hey, bro, I slammed her." So these young women are banged and they're nailed and they're smashed and they're torn up.
And you're rounding first base and second base and scoring. And yeah, no, the locker room analogy is pretty accurate.
Yep. But it all sounds more like, instead of having sex, that they're in some construction site. I mean, so boys grow up in a world in which women are either hypersexualized or absent, and that's a trend right now that's really sad and really affecting all relationships.
That's a trend that's always been really sad, but don't you suppose that that's been sort of defanged a little bit? I mean, fraternity houses are getting thrown off of universities for having that kind of behavior. I would think that probably that amongst the millennials that there's a lot less of that than there used to be. I mean, it's just not cool anymore. If anything, what's really an interesting trend, I mean, is, you know, not only are the genders growing, you know, in some areas they're getting more sensitized to one another, but in other areas there's animosity growing between the two genders, and now you've got this trend where some young kids are growing up and declining to adopt either gender. You know, they don't fill out standard census forms with a standard M or F for male or female. They're using terms like transgender, agender, androgynous, bigender. They don't want to identify with either gender. And my guess is that gay and lesbian relationships are gonna spiral now that you see so many role models just coming out of the closet and seemingly doing just fine in Hollywood or wherever, and it's almost become trendy to be this kind of androgynous person, which is a rather different deviation from the Darwinian, the way that we were biologically designed for males to definitely be males and females to definitely be females. Now you got all kinds of people dwelling in the middle ground, and that's great. And I'm, like I say, I've got all kinds of gay friends. I'm a big fan of people being however they want to be. I always have been.
I know.
But who's going to produce the babies if everybody's androgynous?
Well, indeed. Because you're speaking about gender fluidity, and if we go away from what's been happening just recently with all of this and the androgynous movements, and even before that, we knew that females had a more fluid sexuality. And that was determined by research studies that showed where the woman's vagina was wired up to show arousal with lubrication and all of that, and men the same thing with their penises wired up to show if they're getting erect, to show interest in arousal. Well, women were aroused by lots of things. Women on with men, women with other women, threesomes, bonobo monkeys who are very, very sexual. So lots of things aroused the woman. And for a straight guy, they were pretty much only aroused by male and female sex. And they couldn't get the arousal from gay sex. These are straight men, and that sort of thing. I just want to take a little side trip here because I recently read this, and I think it's fascinating, and it does apply to what we're talking about. So men and women really are different, but guess what they have in common? Well, they have a number of things in common, but this is, in terms of their sexuality, an interest in dominance, submission, and power themes. It seems to be the only...
Dominance, submission, and what?
Power themes.
Oh,
power.
Okay.
So it's the only universal sex interest shared not only by men and women, but by gay and straight, young and old. And everyone is turned on by one person being dominant and the other submissive. And I think that's fascinating. I've had a number, especially some of my clients, couples in their 30s, they really want to experiment with dominance and submission. There is this fascination with this, and apparently it's universal.
And did I hear you right that you were saying that you thought that women were wired, more biologically wired to be accepting of you know, almost heterosexual, homosexual as well as heterosexual sexual relations more so than men? I mean, it's funny because, you know, you think of the beginning of the gay rights movement as being a bunch of guys in San Francisco coming out of the closet, and, you know, and they were getting, you know, most of the attention. But, you know, maybe women are actually going to be more prone to lesbian relationships than guys are going to be prone to gay relationships. I hadn't really thought about that.
Maybe so. And it could be that women don't always feel safe with men. And in order to have a good sexual relationship, you have to be very present. You can't feel anxious. You have to let go. That contributes immensely to orgasms. But the amygdala, which is the fear center of the brain, with early sexual trauma, often gets overwired so that the woman can become hypervigilant. She can be extra anxious. She has trouble being in the moment. And all of these things, so it's very much in the brain, too. And we know more about the brain these days, for about 20 years now, because we can use functional MRIs to look at the brain. But the amygdala has to take a nap, for a woman to be really orgasmic and to be really present. So this requires a certain amount of self-confidence and sexual confidence, to be present. A small study, I've mentioned this on the air, I don't remember if I did it with when you were a guest, but a small study was done wondering if sex therapists had better sex than others. And it turns out, it was a small study, but it turns out that we sex therapists do, because we can have sex without anxiety. We have so much knowledge about sexuality, so we don't have to be anxious about it, and the performance things. And of course, presumably, we've done more personal work too. But this is all very complicated. This is not going to be solved overnight.
Well, it's interesting, and I haven't thought of this, but you know, we were talking about how older women are oftentimes more comfortable with older women than they are with, you know, having to, you know, babysit another guy for the rest of their lives. And the Jane Fonda situation about preferring her female friends. Now, I'm not accusing anybody of, and not that it's an accusation, because people can be lesbians if they want to be, but I'm not trying to call out any older women as necessarily being sexually attracted towards one another. But when you talk about the lack of anxiety and the comfort level that they feel, And the fact that you know, maybe we will see a greater rise in you know, women with women, you know, sexually or not, or maybe we'll find out that in gay relationships there'll be more of them will be women, because you make it sound like they're more wired, like they could go that way. And I hadn't really, like I say, thought of all that, but maybe that's a likely explanation for some of this. And if it is true that women are more comfortable with women sometimes than they are with men, I know women like to, chat with their girlfriends about all kinds of different stuff, the serious stuff that's going on in their lives, whereas the guys, they keep it more to the locker room kind of discussions of, who's made junior partner in a law firm or who's managed to nail what woman or whatever. It is kind of, it's kind of gross, really. And you're right, that is kind of the way it breaks down, but maybe we'll find that that will contribute to the growing gender gap between men and women too. Is that women are just more hardwired to prefer women in certain contexts. I mean, obviously they can't have babies, but women are hardwired to have babies too, and they can't have babies by other women. But so maybe they need a guy for the early stage of their lives. But maybe as time goes by, maybe that explains why the divorce rate's higher with women filing, and maybe it explains why women, don't want to get remarried the way guys do. Maybe women are just more comfortable in their own skin and with their own fellow females than guys are. And as guys continue to get, emasculated is too strong a term, but as guys continue to be sort of backed down in some of their natural habits, maybe this is going to be continue to be a growing gap.
I think it will be. And, of course, the solution for all of this is communication. We need to communicate. We need to ask clarifying questions of our mates. And that's, of course, one of my big roles in doing couples counseling, is to help the couple actually talk to each other. The slight joke is one thing. There's a four-letter word that would make sexual relationships lots better if they did more of it, and it's not F-U-C-K, it's T-A-L-K.
T-A-L-K, yeah, right.
Yeah.
Makes sense. That's certainly what you try to do in your practice, and, it's a lot of the reason why I wrote Divorce with Decency is to try and, get couples thinking about different aspects of their relationships. Like I say, I don't go as deep into the sexual part of it as you do, but it certainly is, there is a overriding tendency, it seems like, for the genders to misunderstand each other if given the chance, and anything we can do to help that understanding is probably a good thing.
Anything that can help, and to just to communicate, to talk, to... So in my practice, I often, not only do I encourage communication, because if they're so angry with each other, they're certainly not going to want to revitalize their sex life till they resolve some of the anger issues. But meantime, we've got guys who are kind of walking on a tightrope of modern masculinity. It's a dilemma for a lot of guys. We don't usually think that men's sexuality is dependent upon their inner life, as I said earlier. But it is. So,
well, it is. It's a bit of a tightrope, and these are first world modern day problems. I mean, when you think of the fact that, for millions and millions of years of prior history, it's been male-female relations have gone back to, and going back to the caveman days, it was that the man was the hunk who could beat off the, fend off the saber-toothed tiger, and the woman was going to be, focused on the child rearing. And now you've got stay-at-home dads and women out earning the men, and the women are more facile with everything except for, the most strenuous forms of physical labor, women are turning out to be much more adept at it than men are. So you've now got a situation where literally centuries of, I'm the man of the house and you're the woman and this is your role and this is my role, and it was all pretty well defined. Now it's changed. So we better stay tracking it.
Yeah. Brad, we got to end this. The music is on. You'll be back first thing in the new year. You and I will be in touch about that. Thank you so much for the program today.
Aloha, and aloha to all your listeners.
Aloha to you and to all the listeners. Happy feet. Happy feet.